Truth Seekers, Mike Malloy here. Thank you very much for tuning in. How was your day? Did you have a good day? Everybody have a good day? I'm glad you had a good day. I have to ask you something. I mentioned this last night on the air about the assault on Lara Logan. And after we signed off the program last night, it occurred to me that there is a rule in reporting, and Tim from LA pointed this out to me, there's a rule in reporting that you do not name the victim of sexual assault. That is in the style book that is used by editors and reporters for not just the Associated Press, but just about every news reporting agency in the United States. I don't know how it is with agencies not in this country. The AP handbook, under handling identification properly, it says, especially in crime stories, people should be identified as fully as possible. Use full name, age, occupation, or any other identifier that would help differentiate the accused from other persons with similar names. Victims of a crime often are not identified. Victims of a crime. This is particularly true in sexual assault cases or when the victim is younger than 18. As Tim writes, granted, the press has the right to post anything they wish, including the names of rape victims, but any sort of sex crime, the victim's name is omitted. It's not a legal issue. It's a privacy issue. And even someone of fame or notoriety, a sexual assault, be it rape or whatever, the reporter nor their editorial board should post the name unless this is the corporation's vengeance for the people of Egypt's revolution from their puppet masters. The way the AP reported it, CBS News correspondent Lara Logan was recovering in a U.S. hospital Tuesday from a sexual attack and beating she suffered while reporting on the tumultuous events in Cairo. So even the Associated Press violated their own handbook. So to the extent that I violated a rule I've known for a long time, I do apologize to the audience for putting it the way I put it, and also to the family of Lara Logan, because it's being done a certain way by other news gathering organizations. Of course, I'm not a news gathering organization, and it had been reported by the time I got my hands on the story, but still, this is not something that is acceptable. So, for my participation in identifying the CBS correspondent as a victim of repeated sexual assault, my apologies. How many of you know who Ray McGovern is? I've quoted his work, his essays on this program many times. One time in Phoenix, I met him. We were doing an event. Who was the guy, Kathy, the Marine weapons inspector that I did a couple of events with? Gosh, I'm trying to blank. Scott Ritter, that's right. Scott and I did an event, I think it was in Phoenix, and in the audience was Ray McGovern. At the time, he was dealing with medical treatment, but he showed up anyway. And he's 71 years old. He is a former CIA analyst for 20 years. He's a veteran Army officer. He's also a member of Veterans for Peace. This is a guy who has done a complete 180 where it concerns his, not just his political take on events that are occurring in this tired planet and in this moving toward fascism country, but also has tried the best he can to expose what he knows about the CIA and about the military and the corruption that is rampant. Well, yesterday, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton gave a speech at George Washington University. And in the speech, she was condemning governments that arrest protesters and who do not allow free expression, right? Because, and we'll talk about this later in the program tonight, the North Africa and the Middle East is just exploding. And this is going to spread. We're in for a rough decade here, Truth Seekers. This is going to be one for the history books, as they say. But anyway, Hillary Clinton was giving a speech, and she was condemning governments that arrest protesters, governments that don't allow free expression, yada, yada, yada. And 71-year-old Ray McGovern was grabbed from the audience in plain view of Hillary Clinton by police and an unidentified official in plain clothes. He was, according to justiceonline.org, he was brutalized and left bleeding in jail. Hillary Clinton never paused speaking. Now, what happened when Clinton began her speech, McGovern remained standing silently in the audience and turned his back on her because he knows that Hillary Clinton is a warmonger. Hillary Clinton is a proto-fascist. Don't kid yourself. Please, I went through this in the run-up to the election in 08. I don't know how many women who supported Hillary Clinton, when I started pointing out her policies, her advocacies, and what she had done as a senator, I was just ripped a new body orifice. How dare you speak out against a female candidate, Mike Malloy? It was awful. I got emails from people who said, from women who had been listening to this program for years, said, that's it. To hell with you. I'm leaving. Because I had the temerity to point out Hillary Clinton's voting record and to label it as I saw it to be. She is a fascist. She is a corporatist. She is whatever she is. Hillary Clinton never paused speaking. As Ray McGovern, and she knows him. She knows who he is. As he was beaten up by police and hauled out of this university. And nobody else did anything either. This is unbelievable. Anyway, when he turned his back, McGovern was wearing a Veterans for Peace t-shirt. Security officers pounced on him. And as he was hauled out the door, McGovern said, "So this is America?" Now, there are pictures online. If you go to Justice Online, justiceonline.org, you'll find them. Scroll down a bit. There's some color photos. He's covered with bruises, lacerations, and contusions inflicted in this assault. Now, he's being represented in a lawsuit, I guess, by the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, PCJF. Attorney Mara Hilliard of the PCJF said, quote, "It is the ultimate definition of lip service that Secretary of State Clinton would be trumpeting the U.S. government's supposed concerns for free speech rights, and this man would be simultaneously brutalized and arrested for engaging in a peaceful act of dissent at her speech," end quote. McGovern now works for Tell the World, which is a publishing arm of the Ecumenical Church of the Savior in the Adams Morgan neighborhood of Washington, D.C. If you would do your humble and obedient servant here a favor and spread the word about this, okay? JusticeOnline.org. justiceonline.org. Check it out. We'll be right back. What, we having a little problem with it?
There it is! Yay!
Past the hour, if you go to TV News Lies, tvnewslies.org, the article about what happened to the governor is up there, and a photograph is there of what happened to him. tvnewslies.org. And there's, I think, Facebook and Twitter connection there where you can spread the word on this. Pretty astonishing. The craziness just keeps increasing almost geometrically from the mouth of Michelle Bachmann. Apparently, she was on some third-rate right-wing radio program yesterday and blasted Michelle Obama's support for breastfeeding babies as evidence of what Michelle Bachmann refers to as nanny state mentality. Who came up? Which one of these right-wing cockroaches came up with that phrase, nanny state, years and years ago? Which one of the cockroaches produced that? Every time I see it, it just sets my teeth on edge, and I just want, I don't know, I want to start punching holes in the nearest oak tree. You know what I'm saying? Bachmann, oh, she was on Laura Ingraham's program yesterday. Bachmann said, quote, this is very consistent with where the hard left is coming from. For them, government is the answer to every problem. I've given birth to 5 babies, and I've breastfed every single one of these babies. To think that government has to go out and buy my breast pump for my babies. I mean, you want to talk about the nanny state? I think you just got the new definition of the nanny state. Michelle Bachmann is probably the most ignorant human being in America that has a platform on which she can display her ignorance. The government does not buy the breast pump. Someone who wants a breast pump buys it themselves. The next year, when it's tax time, the person who bought the breast pump can take a tax deduction for part of the purchase of the breast pump. That's called a tax cut, Bachman, you moronic freak. A tax cut. I thought you and your slimy cockroach crew was in favor of tax cuts. Where do these people come from? Where do these people come from? Last week, the IRS ruled that breast pumps and other nursing supplies are now tax deductible. Nobody buys it for anyone. The whole idea was pushed by the Obama administration, along with more flexible work rules related to breastfeeding. Hello. Michelle Bachman has been promoting breastfeeding, especially among African American women, as a way to help combat childhood obesity. This is part of the Michelle Obama's Let's Move campaign. Now, this isn't the first time the Let's Move campaign has been the target of nanny state attacks. Remember Sarah Palin? She's repeatedly criticized the campaign, right? She made s'mores on her reality show, Sarah Palin's Alaska, back in December, saying she was making the s'mores, quote, "It's an honor, Michelle Bachman, or Michelle Obama, who said the other day we should not have dessert." Jesus God. Then there was a time that she took the cookies to the school. Here, kids, eat the cookies. The president's, the wife of the president of the United States is crazy. Eat cookies. Eat junk. Eat crap. Where do these swine come from? Where do these swine come from? Stay with us. I promise not to let another pretzel near my throat. My brother Jet in Florida will oversee the count. The Supreme Court will decide if we don't get the right amount. From the moment you wake and leave the house in the morning, the terrorists or Democrats could strike without warning. So to your backseat in bed, wear a bucket on your head. That's what I said. And to show your support for right-wing ideology, the raids on Iraq and the rape. Has he mentioned yet tonight how much he hates these people? It's more Mike Malloy. Keep a bucket on your head. You won't need any eye holes. They'll just tell us what we see. We're being led by some wise souls determined to 25 before the hour. The decisions they're making are much too big. The so strike action, the protest action in Madison, Wisconsin, is starting to rival downtown Cairo. According to John Nichols, writing at The Nation Online, more than 10,000 Wisconsinites marched on the state capitol yesterday. As crowds rallied in cities around the state, students walked out of high schools. Public employees lined roadways holding banners declaring their determination to battle an attempt by this Republican governor. How did you people in Wisconsin do this? This Scott Walker, who is trying to strip state workers of their collective bargaining rights and pack state government positions with political patronage appointees. Another huge crowd, according to John Nichols, numbering around 8,000, surrounded the Capitol for a Tuesday night rally. Protests spread to the Milwaukee area, where hundreds of workers massed outside Walker's suburban home. The crowds were bigger today. The city schools are closing as teachers take sick days to join the protests, and buses packed with public employees roll into the city. Many of those who showed up, according to John, for one of the first of what are expected to be days of ever-expanding protests, borrowed themes, language, themes and language from the crowds that filled the streets of Cairo. Signs that yesterday's rally, which the AFL-CIO said attracted a crowd of 15,000, and which news outlets broadly reported drew more than 10,000 state and local employees and their backers. They referred to the governor as Hosni Walker and declared protests like an Egyptian. Another asked, if Egypt can have democracy, why can't Wisconsin? Police barricades were erected on streets around the state capitol as uniformed officers were posted to block protesters from entering parts of the building, where a day-long hearing on the governor's proposal was being held. But the crowd surged into the building after a rally that featured, among others, AFSCME President Gerald McEntee, who identified the Wisconsin fight as a, quote, ground zero, end quote, struggle for organized labor. Hundreds of firefighters whose contracts would be protected under the plan Walker proposes showed up at the Tuesday rally anyway, and drew roars of approval. Republicans control the governorship, of course, in both houses of the state legislature. However, some veteran Republican legislators, like State Senator Luther Olson, who represents many unionized workers. How could that be? How could a Republican state senator, I mean, if he's really a Republican, represent unionized workers? How can that be? Oh, well. Luther Olson, among other Republicans, have suggested that the governor's power grab is simply, quote, too radical, end quote. The longest-serving member of the legislature, State Senator Fred Risser, a Democrat from Madison, Wisconsin, well-liked, it says here, John Nichols reports, by both senior Democrats and Republicans, has said, quote, without a willingness to even discuss what concessions need to be made with state employees, the governor comes across more like a dictator and less like a leader. Well, of course. Of course. Brenda Klein, a food service worker from Green Bay, said, quote, I went to the polls last November and voted to protect our freedoms from government threat and to create jobs. I never dreamed that this would be the result. The bill being rammed through the legislature does the opposite, and it must be stopped, end quote. Obviously, Ms. Klein voted for a Republican, believing the nonsense and lies and deceit that these right-wing bastards put out there. I don't care if they're in Wisconsin. Well, they're not as sneaky about it here in the South. These right-wing scum, the cockroaches here in the South, they come right out and tell you, we're going to stop this public education crap. I may be exaggerating a little bit there, but that's what they're doing. Governor Walker, shaken a bit by all this, conscious that he has stirred up unprecedented anger in Wisconsin, has threatened to call out the National Guard to put down protests. An archivist for the Wisconsin Historical Society, an archivist, showed up at yesterday's rally wearing a white T-shirt on which she had written, quote, I am not afraid of the National Guard, end quote. My God. Well, good. I mean, in a sense, good. In a sense, real good. Maybe this will wake people up. Not the union members. They already know what a death struggle this country is involved in. But maybe other people will get it. You think? Do you think possibly, maybe people will wake up about what these filthy Republican scum are about? In Florida, the new governor down there, an absolute criminal, a guy who's, was it his health insurance company, was involved in the biggest fraud and theft in the state's history? Right? Scott? What's his first name? Scott? Rick? Scott? Rick? Hey, Rick. Hey, Rick, what's happening, baby? Rick? He was backed by the Tea Party. Florida's Republican Governor Rick Scott unveiled plans for a state budget last week that would cut as much as $5 billion over the current fiscal year from education, pensions for state workers, assistance to the homeless and the unemployed, Medicare benefits, and other programs that benefit who? The working class. The budget proposal to be debated in the majority Republican state legislature this week also includes $4 billion in tax cuts by 2012. The budget envisions eliminating the corporate income tax entirely within the next 7 years. Oh, Florida is one of the few states with no personal income tax. The lion's share of the proposed cuts will come from education. Where does Florida rank? Right in the goddamn toilet, doesn't it? Huh? Where it concerns education? The budget would cut state funding for education by $3.3 billion. This amounts to a 10% cut at a time when Florida's public schools consistently rank among the worst in the nation. The superintendent of one of Florida's largest public school districts, Miami-Dade County, told the Miami Herald that the cuts represented, quote, the beginning of the demise of our public school system, end quote. The district faces a potential $214 million cut to its $4 billion budget. Neighboring Broward County expects cuts up to $205 million. Both districts are still reeling from $100 million cuts from the past 3 years, so they're going to have to lay off large numbers of teachers, bus drivers, and custodians. Jesus, God. Rick Scott's budget, this billionaire, this thieving son of a bitch, this corporate predator. Way to go, Florida, you morons! His budget proposes laying off more than 7,000 employees throughout the state government. Oh, and today, I heard today, he turned down a $2 billion government grant to build high-speed rail between Orlando and Tampa. A $2 billion government grant. Do you know how many jobs that would have created? These are your Republicans. This is the thug. This is the thief, the liar. He made millions as the chief executive of Columbia Hospital Corporation of America, the largest private for-profit healthcare company in the country. And he was forced to resign in 1997 after the company was charged with defrauding Medicare. Do you know how much? Do you know what the charges were? And this slimy cockroach escapes. And now he's governor? What is wrong with you people in Florida and Wisconsin? Dear God. Okay. You put him in office. You put these cockroaches in office. So hold on to your asses, Wisconsinites and Floridians, whatever the hell you're called. And how many other states? Hold on to your asses, because these Republicans are determined to knock you out, destroy your family, make sure you can't pay your bills, watch your house be foreclosed on you, and laugh their asses off. They do this because they can. They're billionaires, and they hate you. They hate you. And shipping jobs offshore. You wish it's all.
truth. It's more Mike Malloy.
Ten before the hour. This Rick Scott in Florida, whose company committed, I think it was the biggest fraud, Medicare fraud in the history of Medicare. And he resigned. I don't have the case in front of me right now. I don't know if any of his inner circle of executives went to prison for what they had done. But he damn sure didn't, and now he's governor of Florida. You people are crazy. You Floridians, I swear to God, you don't care. I mean, who's the Daryl Issa? Isn't he a convicted felon? Oliver North, isn't he a convicted? I mean, it just goes on and on and on with these people. His budget proposal was delivered to a Tea Party gathering and was supported by various tea bag organizations. And it was one of the consequences all of this was happening in Florida, the right-wing policy of the Democratic Party. What has happened? As Ed Hightower writes, the policies of the Obama administration over the past 2 years, which led to a sharp drop in Democratic Party votes in the 2010 elections, paved the way for the victory of Republican Party candidates in state and local races throughout the country. That's what happened. And there you go. And I think it's great. Let these sons of bitches have exactly what they want. As far as Democrats not voting anymore to support Democrats who are lying, Republican light, to hell with them. But what we have to do, we former Democrats now, is get behind candidates who are strong and honest and decent and progressive and who will offset the cockroaches, because the cockroaches are eating the country alive. They're just eating it alive. Oh, by the way, as Ed Hightower points out, not Jim Hightower, Ed Hightower, at both the national and state level, the entire political establishment is moving sharply to the right. Scott's proposal came the week before Obama himself announced a federal budget proposal that cuts more than $1 trillion in federal spending, almost entirely from programs that benefit the working class and the poorest sections of society. While enacting cuts at the federal level, Mr. Obama is encouraging even deeper cuts in state and local government services by refusing any federal aid. Now, the universal claim for all this is that there is no alternative but to enact cuts, that there is simply no money for essential social programs. In fact, Florida is among the most unequal of U.S. states, ranking fourth behind California, New York, and Texas in the number of individuals on the Forbes 400 list of the wealthiest Americans. California first, New York second, Texas third, and then Florida. Now, included among Florida's 26 names on the list of the 400 wealthiest Americans, Mickey Arison, chairman of the cruise line giant Carnival Corporation, who is worth $4.1 billion. Oil investor William Koch, brother of David and Charles Koch, the principal bankrollers of the Tea Party, $3.4 billion. Energy tycoon Terrence Pegula, $3 billion. Real estate investors Malcolm Glazer and Igor Olenikov, $2.5 billion each. But the combined net wealth of all 26 of these capitalist swine is $47 billion, which is nine times the total amount of Governor Scott's proposed budget cuts for next year. 26 people, $47 billion. Now, how long are normal, average Americans going to allow this? While the billionaires continue their greed, their filthy lust for money, their FU attitude to the rest of the country that provided all this for them, gave them the opportunity, they don't contribute, they're cockroaches. hundreds of thousands, millions of kids being turned out into the goddamn streets. No school, no health care, no way for their parents to keep their mortgage payments or their rent payments. And these filth just continue to destroy the country. How much longer? What is it going to take? What did it take the Egyptians? Oh, that's right. 30 years. How long have we been putting up with this? 30 years. How much longer? How much longer? I am stunned. Everything being cut. Except what should be cut. And that is the tax-exempt status of these thugs. They get away with everything. Robert Reich, Clinton's labor secretary, he proposes to raise the marginal tax to 70% on incomes over $15 million a year, 60% on incomes between $5 and $15 million, 50% on incomes between $500,000 and $5 million. And he has a reason for suggesting this. I'll share it with you when we come back. Stick around. I'm Mike Malloy. Seven past the hour. Now, thank God there are still people in this country like the public sector workers, school teachers, and state workers in Wisconsin who are willing to say to this fascist governor, screw you, we're not going to participate in this. I know a lot of people say, well, there's a lot of abuses in the public sector, pension plans and so on and so forth. If that's the case, then reform it. What was the saying about some other legislation a few years ago? Mend it, don't end it, or whatever. But enough is enough. Anyway, back to Robert Reich writing at his blog site, robertreich.org. He said, maybe people forget that From roughly 1940 to 1980, America's highest marginal tax rate averaged above 70%. Now, you know what they mean by that. The millionaires and the billionaires. These are the taxes they paid. As well, they damn well should have. Under Republican President Dwight Eisenhower, it was 91%. That was the marginal tax rate. Kennedy lowered it. Not until the 1980s did Ronald Reagan slash it to 28%. And as Reich points out, during these years, the nation's pre-tax income was far less concentrated at the top than it is now. In the mid-70s, for example, the top 1% got around 9% of total income. By 2007, they got 23.5%. So if anything, the argument for a higher marginal tax should be even more realistic now than it was during the days when it was taken for granted. What kind of a greed-head, rat-roach bastard walks around with a net worth of $4 billion? What is that? That's condemnable, isn't it? Well, of course it is. Why are you screaming? So why are the tax rates... The tax rates right now are lower than they have been, I think, in forever. Didn't we talk about that a couple of weeks ago? So Robert Reich says the disconnect with the world as it exists today, is that the reason that the ultra-wealthy just absolutely refuse? They give the rest of the country the middle finger and say, I'm not paying you, I'm not paying anything. To hell with you. So as Reich says, that's exactly the point of proposing a 70% tax on incomes over 15 million, 60% between 5 and 15 million, 50% on incomes between half a million and 5 million. That's the point of proposing it. For years, he writes, progressives have whined. The Democratic presidents, Clinton followed by Obama, compromise with Republicans while Republican presidents stand their ground, with the result that the center of the political debate has moved steadily to the right. That's the reason the world exists the way it does today. Isn't it about time that progressives had the courage and got behind what we believe in the hope of moving the debate back to where it was? Huh? Let me see a show of hands. How many progressives out there have some courage? Hello? Any courage in the house tonight? Oh, there's one, two, five. Would a Democratic president be insane to propose this kind of tax structure? 70% on incomes over 15 million. Reich says not at all. In fact, polls show an increasing portion of the electorate angry with this insider establishment, you know, Wall Street, corporate suites, Washington, that's been feathering its nest at the public's expense. More importantly, Reich writes, it will soon become evident to most Americans that the only way to reduce the budget deficit, preserve programs deemed essential by the middle class and not raise taxes on the middle, is to tax the top. Well, hello. And this crapola idea that may have been applicable back in the 40s or 50s in this country, that the average working class or middle class person in this country, this fantasy, I don't think we ought to tax the millionaires because I wouldn't want to be taxed to that rate. Yeah, but you're not a millionaire. Yeah, but I might become one. Yeah, how are you going to do that? Well, I don't know, but I might. That fantasy has been pounded into the heads of how many millions of middle-class Americans to the point where they refuse to get behind the idea of making the wealthy and the ultra-wealthy and the mega-wealthy pay their share. I hear these millionaires, multimillionaires on talk radio, like Bortz and his ilk, talking about a flat tax. Well, there ought to be a consumer tax. That's what, you know, no income tax. No, hell no. In fact, Reich writes, a Democratic president should propose a major permanent tax reduction on the middle class and the working class. He writes, I suspect most of the public would find this attractive. But here again, the only way to accomplish this without busting the bank is to raise taxes on the rich. Yes. Republicans, Reich writes, have done a masterful job over the last 30 years convincing the public that any tax increase on the top is equivalent to a tax increase on everyone. Selling the snake oil of trickle-down economics and the patent lie that most middle-class people will eventually become millionaires. No, we won't. You and I will never, ever enter into that realm. We will not. Even though that's what we were taught, right? We were taught, hey, the door's wide open. Just get out your bootstraps. Beat the living hell out of anyone who comes near you with your bootstraps. Kill them. Step on them. Greed is good. Hello? It won't happen, truth seeker. What do you want anyway? I mean, what? Somebody has a $30, $40 billion net worth. What does that mean? Does that mean they'll live longer than you or me? Maybe they'll be like Cheney and get pumps and crap stuffed into their chest. But eventually, they die and rot and turn to dust too. What did their money do for them? Nothing. Gave them a few toys while they were alive so they could, leave the country and leave this country and leave that country so they wouldn't have to see all the poverty. Oh, God, we used to go to Aruba. Can't go there anymore. Ooh, the nasty brown people. They just come at you like flies around a dung heap as soon as you pull your yacht in. Hell, they're jumping in the harbors. Money! Throw us money! A Democratic President, Reich writes, would do well to rebut all these falsehoods by proposing a truly progressive tax. Yes. Will the rich avoid it? Other critics of my proposal, Reich writes, say there's no way to have a truly progressive tax because the rich will always find ways to avoid it by means of clever accountants and tax attorneys. But this argument proves too much. Regardless of where the highest marginal tax rate is set, the rich will always manage to reduce what they owe. During the 50s, when it was 91%, they exploited loopholes and deductions that, as a practical matter, reduced the effective top rate to 50 or 60%. Yet that's still substantial by today's standards. The lesson is government should aim high, expecting that well-paid accountants will reduce whatever the rich owe. Okay, make it 95%. Then the roachy bastards will wind up paying 55 or 60%. Huh? We'll be right back. Idea, Robert Reich's idea here of taxing the rich, the marginal tax rates up where they make sense, 70% for people who make over $15 million a year, 60% on incomes between $5 million and $15 million per year, and 50% on incomes between $500,000 and $15 million a year. And he points out that the marginal tax rate, these upper limit tax rates, have always been high until the Reagan years. And this idea, and now he gets to the nub of it in this blog post he's put up here. This gets to the part that just drives me to the point where I start to become hysterical. He writes, besides the argument that the nation shouldn't impose an obligation on the rich because they can wiggle out of it is an odd one. Taken to its logical extreme, it would suggest we allow the rich to do whatever antisocial act they want. Grand larceny, homicide, plunder, because they can always manage to avoid responsibility for it. Who was it over the years who said that rich people never go to jail? Rich people, rich white people can commit murder and be found innocent, no matter how guilty they are, right? Or found not guilty, no matter how guilty they are. Rice says, some critics worry that if the marginal tax is raised too high, the very rich will simply take their money to a more hospitable jurisdiction. That's surely possible. Some already do. But paying taxes is a central obligation of citizenship. You teabag bastards, you. Those who take their money abroad in an effort to avoid American taxes should lose their American citizenship. Hello? Finally, Reich says, there are some who say my proposal doesn't stand a chance because the rich have too much political power. It's true that as income and wealth have moved to the top, political clout has risen to the top as well. But to succumb to cynicism about the possibility of progressive change because of the power of those at the top is to give up the battle before it's even started. Haven't we had enough of that? I think he's referring to our Democratic president with that last line, that last question. Haven't we had enough of that, giving up before we even start? Huh? I am so in favor of this. Of course, I would take it one step further. I mean, when you have used your predatory powers, behind every great fortune, there's criminal activity. You know that as well as I do. I don't care where you live. When you have used your predatory powers to amass the kind of monstrous piles of cash, like 30, 40 billion, my attitude is confiscate it. Leave the son of a bitch enough to live on and take it all. Take it all. Because in order to get to the point of having a net worth of 30 or 40 billion, you have done something, many somethings, illegal, immoral, sneaky, devious. You've avoided this, you've avoided that, you sidestepped over here. There is no such thing as an honestly gotten $30 billion net worth. Is there, truth seeker?
Well, Mike, what about George Soros and Bill Gates?
What about them?
Well, what about the Facebook boy?
What about him?
What about the Googles, the Googlets?
What about them? So, you know, I'm of the opinion that when the revolution comes, you know, in this little fantasy world I live in, when the revolution comes, as far as this kind of wealth, where did it come from? Are these the people that control this amount of wealth? Is this as a result of their own labors? Is it because they got up every morning at 6 a.m. and, you know, after milking the cows and getting the kids off to school, they went off and worked their asses off and made all this money? Or has it come to them through some other means? How do you amass $30 or $40 billion worth of net wealth? How do you do that? Net worth. How do you do it? By working or by exploiting every person, everything you can come within two counties of? Exploit it all. Steal it, take it, manipulate it. Fire people. Avoid paying taxes. Avoid responsibility. Cheat, lie, sneak, steal. That's the American way, isn't it? That's why, you know, your average factory worker, remember them? Yeah, well, I'm going to be rich someday. I don't want to tax the wealthy. Hell, I'm going to be wealthy. So how you are? How are you going to do that? Well, I'm going to work hard. Yeah. Yeah. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy.
A child can do. How long? child survive? How long? How long? If it was up to you, when you think about the money spent on the fence by a girl and the weapons of destruction we build, we're so sure that we
crazy breeze.
Boom, 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 boom. Bang, 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 bang. Boom, 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 boom. Bang, 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 bang. I love the way you walk, and I love the way you talk.
He's the voice inside your head. It's Mike Malloy.
And you talk that talk. You knocks me out, out off of my feet. Boom, boom, boom.
25 before the hour.
Bang, bang, bang. Boom, 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 boom.
From Maine. Yeah, things are even weird in Maine. They have a Republican governor there now. Maine. Well, that's where Olympia Snow and, what's her name? Susan Collins are from, right? Kathy in Maine writes, just like the Republican-held states across the country, our Republic thugs are up to no good. Two bills are going into legislative work session in Maine this week. One would require voters to present photo IDs at the polls, and the other would do away with same-day voter registration. Well, I'll tell you what, Kathy, welcome to the South. I mean, we've had that here in Georgia. Oh, yeah. Kathy writes, of course, these conscientious Republic thugs are citing the reduction of voter fraud that makes these two bills so necessary. Voter fraud! Gotta reduce it! Never mind that there have only ever been two cases of voter fraud here in Maine. And those two cases both involve people voting twice under their own names in different precincts. This certainly doesn't indicate the huge conspiracy of fraud the Republic thugs seem to so interested in addressing. In fact, it only perpetuates the voter fraud myth. In reality, the only thing both of these proposed bills will do is make it difficult for the elderly to vote because they don't have photo IDs if they no longer drive, and make it harder for young people and others who need to register on the same day of the election for various reasons. The combined effect equals fewer votes cast. Yep, yep, yep. And the Republic thugs know that low voter turnout will give them the advantage in every election. We are witnessing Republic thugs everywhere who are entirely and only interested in taking away the rights of the people they're supposed to be working for in order to better their chances for total and uninterrupted control. And so it goes in Maine, Wisconsin, Ohio, Tennessee, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey, to name just a few of the states currently struggling under Republic thug rule. Increasingly unhappy in a red state, Kathy in Maine. Wisconsin. 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 Oh, Uncle Clarence Thomas is back in the news. You see this? You see this one? Oh, Jesus God. No wonder this guy shuts his goddamn mouth and never, never questions anybody. He just sits there. Well, Fat Tony Scalia and Sammy the Fish Alito run interference, destroying the country. Carolee at Crooks and Liars points out that Clarence Thomas is falling into a deep, deep ethical hole, deeper even than the one he dropped into when he failed to disclose his wife's income for 20 years. Remember that? We talked about it. As more facts come to light, it's obvious he failed to disclose quite a bit, including the $100,000 Citizens United. Yes, Citizens United spent on his behalf in 1991 to support his nomination. Now, here's a Time magazine excerpt from a Time magazine article from 1991, okay? Ancient by God history. Here's what it says. Washington area television viewers were startled last week to see three familiar senatorial faces pop up on their screens above the words, "Who will judge the judge?" The follow-up question, how many of these liberal Democrats could themselves pass ethical scrutiny? It was hardly necessary since the faces were those of Edward Kennedy, Joseph Biden, and Alan Cranston. All scarred veterans of highly publicized scandals from Chappaquiddick to plagiarized speeches to the Keating Five. The ad, produced by two independent right-wing groups, was intended to bolster Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas's confirmation chances by pointing the finger at three liberal Democrats who seem likely to oppose him. Not coincidentally, the ad was produced by the same people who launched the 1988 Willie Horton spot that branded Michael Dukakis as soft on crime, but left George Bush open to charges of racism. Anxious not to be associated with such negative campaigning this time around, Bush quickly labeled the attacks on the senators counterproductive. They're talking about Herbert Walker. Thomas, Uncle Clarence, pronounced them vicious. His chief Senate supporter, Missouri Republican John Danforth, called them sleazy, scurrilous. That would be Ed Kennedy, Joe Biden, and Alan Cranston. Although Bush and Chief of Staff John Sununu, that's George Herbert Walker Bush, and Chief of Staff John Sununu demanded that the ads be pulled, their right-wing sponsors, L. Brent Bozo III, chairman of the Conservative Victory Committee, and Floyd Brown, chairman of Citizens United, refused. Oh, no, we're not pulling the ads. Calling the campaign, the ads, a preemptive strike to counter anticipated anti-Clarence Thomas commercials, as well as retaliation for the 1987 spots that helped defeat Supreme Court nominee Robert Bork. They, L. Brent Bozell and Floyd Brown, vowed to keep running the messages for at least 2 weeks until the left agrees to discontinue all the efforts against Judge Thomas. Blah, blah, blah. So, as Carol Lee points out at Crookston-Meyer, Citizens United pays to produce and air an ad with the stated intention of bullying the left into silence over Uncle's nomination. And Uncle Clarence fails to disclose all that before hearing last year's Citizens United case that corrupted our election process. How about that? How about that, huh? Ironically, the case Protect Our Elections is relying on is Caperton versus Massey, ruled on by the Supreme Court in 2009. Predictably, Thomas, Scalia, Roberts, and Alito dissented. Applying Caperton to Citizens United, it is clear that Justice Thomas, after having been supported by an effective advertising campaign that reaped millions in free media time, labored under an actual conflict of interest that denied the FEC due process. Justice Thomas owed his spot on the court to Citizens United. That fact undermined his ability to put aside his bias in favor of Citizens United. Well, gee, I didn't know any of this, Truth Seeker, did you? I had no idea. Justice Thomas was required, you see, to disclose his relationship with Citizens United and recuse himself from the case. Instead, he hid the relationship and cast the deciding vote in favor of Citizens United. Now, in doing so, he corrupted the administration of justice and violated the rules of professional conduct, Rule 8.4, misconduct, which states in pertinent part, quote, "It is professional misconduct for a lawyer to A, violate or attempt to violate the rules of professional conduct, knowingly assist or induce another to do so, or do so through the acts of another. Engage in conduct involving dishonesty, fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation. Engage in conduct that seriously interferes with the administration of justice, blah, blah, blah. Seems like Justice Thomas has a really distorted idea of what justice is. When do we start impeaching Uncle Clarence? I mean, it just never stops, does it? It never stops. It just goes on and on like a huge flowing river of swill from these right-wingers. Uncle Clarence, Tommy, or I should say Sammy the Fish Alito, Anthony Fat Tony Scalia. And that's just on the Supreme Court. Then you have the criminals, the lawbreakers in the Republican Party who are now in positions of power in the House. You have the lawbreakers and criminals now in positions of power in the governor's mansions around the country. I hope that the strikers in Madison and Milwaukee and Green Bay and wherever they are resisting this right-wing governor in Wisconsin, I hope you all don't stop. You know, the Egyptians held out for 18 days. That's all it took. You know, we former Democrats, we progressives, we've got to start backing candidates. We have got to have people on the ballot that we can vote for. Or we're going to lose it entirely. Here you don't need us. Say that the war here is over. The four of us die every day. And I don't know why we are fighting. Was it all just a lie anyway? Like me. Never let your feelings show. Make it breeze. Before the hour, Kathy tells me there is a new gallery up at MikeMalloy.com. What, photos from the cruise? Okay. Check them out. MikeMalloy.com, the gallery. Coming up next hour, we're going to shift gears dramatically and take a look at... Take a look at what is going on in several Muslim states in North Africa and the Middle East. I think you'll find it very interesting. So stick around for that. Arizona again. Oh, my God. Republican lawmakers in Arizona want to widen their illegal immigrant crackdown with a proposal that would require hospitals to check on whether patients are in the country legally. One assumes it's before treatment. Somebody comes in with a heart attack or a stroke. They're still in that golden hour. And these crazy sons of bitches in Arizona, these Republicans, want the medical team to stop and find out whether or not the person who is now starting to die in front of them is in the country illegally before treatment resumes. Medical professionals, as you can imagine, are outraged by this for a number of reasons, not the least of which it would turn them into de facto immigration agents. According to the Associated Press, the medical industry, causes a shiver, ripped the bill yesterday as it was scheduled for a hearing by the Senate Judiciary Committee in Arizona. Doctors envisioned scenarios in which immigrants with contagious diseases like tuberculosis would stay home from the clinic or hospital and put themselves and the public at a grave health risk. Of course, but Republicans don't give a goddamn. They don't care about that because they can't think. They don't think like that. They are greedy, self-referential bastards. So they don't know. Of course they don't think. Well, what about people with contagious? Oh, well, they shouldn't be here anyway. George Paulk, a retired doctor with an organization called Physicians for a National Health Program. Oh, my God. Physicians for a National Health Program said, quote, "This is making us into a police state. It would try to catch people when they are sick. Do we want to stop sick people from coming in for health care?" End quote. If you're a Republican, of course you do. You want to kill children. You want to see them starve to death. You want to deny them education. You want to deny mothers and children who are low income or no income thanks to Republican policies. You want to deny them food. Because after all, they have Cadillacs hidden someplace, you know, and they'll take their women, infants, children vouchers and sell it to some hustler on the street corner and then use it for gasoline to put in their Cadillac. Right? Republican cockroaches. Arizona is the first legislature, of course, to take up such a measure. According to the National Conference of State Legislatures. The discussion about this bill comes just days after an illegal immigrant in Texas with a banana-sized tumor on her spine said she was tossed out of the hospital because of her immigration status. She later found another hospital to get treatment. Supporters say the hospital bill is necessary to fight illegal immigrants at a time when hospitals lose tens of millions of dollars treating illegal immigrants in emergency rooms. The president of the Arizona Senate, Russell Pierce, a Mesa, Arizona Republican who was chief sponsor of last year's immigration law, says the hospital bill is part of a broader effort to crack down on illegal immigrants. He said, quote, "The hospital bill wouldn't bar people from getting care, but it would put the onus on hospitals to do due diligence. We're going to enforce our laws without apology. It's the law. It's a felony to aid and abet. We're going to force the law without apology. You're goddamn right. We're going to do it because this is what Jesus would do. No money, no honey. You want to be treated? Not here. What do you think we are?" The legislation would require hospitals, when admitting non-emergency cases, to confirm that a person seeking care in the U.S. is a U.S. citizen or in the country legally. In emergency cases, when the patient isn't here legally, the hospital would be required to call immigration authorities after the treatment is done. Hospitals in non-emergency situations would also be required to contact federal authorities. I knew Republicans were cockroaches and scum. I just never thought that it could get this bad. I really never did. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Mike Malloy. Welcome back. 7 past the hour. We continue on the Malloy program. The fruit seller. Do you know what I'm talking about? The fruit seller, young guy in Tunisia. How old is he? About 25 years old, 26 years old. The man who who is being credited, is that the right word, with starting this tidal wave of revolution across northern Africa and the Middle East. Drawn a blank on his name. I'm embarrassed. But he was a young guy who wanted to open a fruit stand in Tunis. And didn't have the money for a permit. And to make a long story short, in protest of what happened to him when he tried to open a fruit stand, he set himself on fire. Now, there are some of us who remember a Buddhist monk in Saigon in 1964 or 65, whose name was, I can't pronounce it, T-H-I-C-H, and then there was more to it. But I remember seeing the picture on television, believe it or not, 1964, the Buddhist monk who, in defiance of the government of Ngozi Dzinzhiem, our puppet dictator in South Vietnam, this monk set himself on fire. Now, if you're over a certain age, you remember that. So, this Tunisian fruit seller, young guy, couldn't open up a little business, because he didn't have the money for the license or the permit or something. I should have researched the story a little bit more in depth, I admit. But his death is what has triggered this wave of, call it what you want, insurrection, revolution, resistance across so many countries. I want to touch on that here for just a second. But first, there is a website, a news source, Al-Bawaba. Yeah, don't laugh, just because it sounds funny in English. Al-Bawaba.com, and they're reporting a security source close to Egypt's military council said late last night that the source, would not be surprised if at any moment there is an announcement about the death of former President Hosni Mubarak. The source said, quote, his health is deteriorating drastically and he refuses to receive the necessary treatment, end quote. The source said attempts were being made to transfer Mubarak for treatment abroad, but apparently Mubarak refuses to leave, refuses to respond. He asked those around him to let him die in his country. The source said, it's only a matter of time. It is unfortunate it ends up this way. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. See if you, see if that happens within the next short period of time. So across North Africa and the Middle East, here you go. You ready for this? The wave of turmoil and protest sweeping the Middle East appeared today, Wednesday, to have reached Libya, ruled for 40 years by Colonel Muammar al-Qaddafi. It's according to news reports. The violence erupted in Libya's second city, Benghazi. It was not reported in the state-run media, which said rallies would be held Wednesday in support of Colonel Gaddafi. Jesus. Corina, a privately owned newspaper in Benghazi, said a crowd armed with gasoline bombs and rocks protested outside a government office to demand the release of a human rights activist. They then went to Shahara Square, and there was a pitched battle with police. The Times reports that the eruption in Libya was highly unusual since a pervasive security apparatus keeps dissent in check and protects Colonel Gaddafi against perceived foes, some of whom are Islamists. Reuters news agency is quoting a Benghazi resident as saying the protesters were led by relatives of prisoners in the Abu Salim jail in Tripoli, where political detainees are held. The prison is notorious for a massacre of more than 1,000 inmates in June of 1996. Yeah, they just, the military just went in and started slaughtering people. 1,000 butchered. In other parts of the Arab world, protesters are using social networking sites like Twitter and Facebook to call for demonstrations. And so it goes. That's Libya. Yemen. Large numbers of police officers took up positions around the capital of Sana'a today in an attempt to end 6 days of running street battles between small groups of pro- and anti-government protesters. They're calling for the immediate ouster of President Ali Abdullah Saleh. Reuters again reports that several hundred students had marched through the streets from Sana'a University. The police moved to block students from demonstrating. Demonstrators broke free. There was no indication of violence against them. In the city of Taiz, thousands of students who have occupied the streets in overnight protests that began on Friday vowed to remain there until Saleh steps down. Police have arrested 130, have been injured. There are also fresh protests by southern secessionists in Aden, where demonstrations have been notably more violent. One protester, 20-year-old student, was said to have been shot to death in battles with police today. What else? Iraq. Security forces in the eastern Iraqi city of Kut on Wednesday today fired on a group of protesters calling for the province's governor to step down. Three people killed. After the police opened fire, the protesters stormed the governor's headquarters and his home, burning both, according to the official. 27 people injured. Wednesday's protests were organized by a group called the Youth of Kut, which wants the governor of the province to step down because he has failed to create jobs and increase the supply of electricity. An official said that the governor, Latif Hamad al-Tarfa, was in Baghdad today. A protester said, quote, at 10 a.m. in the morning, we all gathered in the central city, and we were heading to the building of the provincial council and the governor's building. We had a delegation that went up and asked for the governor to step down. They refused to come out and talk to us. The protester said the security forces then began shooting. Quote, when they opened fire on us, I was feeling that we are not a free country. We are under a dictatorship system. This is Iraq. I tell them one thing. We will not stop going out on protest unless the governor steps down and leaves us. Kut is a Shiite city of about 850,000 people, close to Iraq's border with Iran. And moving on, in Iran, 2 days after the largest anti-government protest in Iran in more than a year, supporters and opponents of the authorities fought today in a battle for the memory of a protester killed in the demonstration. The clashes erupted at Tehran University during the funeral of Sahani Zala, one of two students reported killed during protests Monday. The government, the ruling council, the Muslim mullahs running the government have said, and had the parliament has said, they will arrest and execute the leaders of these particular demonstrations.
no more Mr. Nice Guy. Here's Mike Malloy.
Past the hour. All right, Libya, the Libyan city of Benghazi, and Tripoli, Yemen, in the capital, Sana'a, and the southern part of Yemen, in the secessionists in Aden, or Aden, Iraq, the eastern Iraqi city of Kut, Iran, students in Iran, at a funeral in memory of one of the two students reported killed during protests on Monday. Yesterday, Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad dismissed opposition attempts to revive mass demonstrations as doomed to fail. Members of the Iranian parliament demanded the two most prominent leaders of the protest movement to be executed. Mir Hussein Mousavi and Mehdi Karoubi are the two. They want to hang them. In Bahrain, Manama, Bahrain, hours after thousands of protesters poured into the nation's center, symbolic center, Pearl Square. Hundreds of people carried pro-democracy protests into a third straight day today, joining a procession to mourn a demonstrator killed in a clash with security forces. News reports said about 2,000 people camped out in the major at the major road junction in the city center demanding a change in the government. In Bahrain. Now, Bahrain, you know, is the home of United States Navy's 5th Fleet. That is the battle group that, or that is the fleet that would be used as support for an invasion, nuclear or otherwise, an attack on Iran. Police massed nearby but did not intervene, apparently anxious to avoid further violent confrontation like yesterday. Two people have been killed in confrontations since Monday. Bahrain. One of the demonstrators, Hussein Ramadan, 32, a political activist and organizer, said, quote, "We are going to get our demands. The people are angry. But we will control our anger. We will not burn a single tire or throw a single rock. We will not go home until we succeed. They want us to be violent. We will not." And of course, Bahrain, as you know, is a playground for the ultra-wealthy in Saudi Arabia. You know, the Saudi royal family, which is just damn near everybody in the country, they, you know, they follow Islamic law. They're not allowed to do sex, drugs, and rock and roll. So they drive over a causeway to Bahrain to enjoy the nightclubs and bars, and whorehouses and you know, sex with children. And the Saudi royal family is notoriously corrupt. And part of the reason for that is our support of them, of course. The ruler of Bahrain is King Hamad bin Isa Al Khalifa, an important ally of the United States in fighting terrorism. And we use him to counter Iranian influence in the region. But the demands, the people, what started in Bahrain, the demands are economic. People want jobs as well as political demands. And as reported here by somebody, I don't know where I'm getting all this stuff, most of the people would like to see the nation transformed from an absolute monarchy into a constitutional monarchy. Uh, In a rare speech to the nation, the king in Bahrain, the king expressed his regret over the two young men killed by the police, called for an investigation. Okay. But in an unparalleled move, he also instructed his police force to allow more than 10,000 demonstrators to claim Pearl Square as their own. I think the attitude is, go ahead, you dumb bastard. See how long you can stay there. No money, no food, no nothing. You want passive resistance? Go ahead. Resist passively. If any of you do anything, we will kill you. Bahrain. Now, Bahrain is interesting. The king and the ruling elite are Sunnis, the majority, or about 70% of the local population of 500,000 are Shiite. The Shia claim they are discriminated against in jobs, housing, education. That's in Bahrain. Where else? How about Pakistan? Pakistan is about ready to explode. More on that when we come back.
Free fun and frivolity with Mike Malloy.
Tonight's the night, all systems clear. Hey, you!
25 before the hour. So, where are we here? We've got Libya. Well, Tunisia, Egypt, Libya, Yemen, Iraq, Iran, Bahrain. And now Pakistan, if you haven't been following what's been going on in Pakistan, a U.S. diplomat there, a former Special Forces guy, former CIA, he's now a diplomat, he shot and killed two people. In that country, the American shot and killed two people in Lahore, Pakistan. The U.S. is claiming he has diplomatic immunity. The American cannot be charged with the crime, any crime. The American claims that this is a robbery attempt, and he had to shoot both of them dead. A little bit more to the story. Also reported dead, a bystander who was run over by U.S. diplomatic vehicle after the shooting. And the wife of one of the dead men, I'm not sure if it was the one run over or one of the alleged robbers, but the wife of one of the dead men apparently committed suicide when informed of her husband's death. She reports from Middle Eastern news agencies say she drank rat poison and died. So we have four deaths. And at the center of it is an American former Special Forces, CIA, SEAL. I don't know. Who in the hell knows what these people are? But it's gotten serious. So Senator John Kerry, chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, was sent to Pakistan. He arrived late last night, and he said today that he's there to reaffirm U.S. support for the strategic relationship between the two countries. Huh? How about that? He's there to reaffirm U.S. support for the strategic relationship between the two countries, which has absolutely nothing to do with the real reason he's there. Diplomatic relations between the U.S. and Pakistan are in the toilet anyway because we insist on sending drone aircraft into their country to murder their people. Yesterday, President Obama said that Pakistan had to release this guy, the American, warning that his prosecution could endanger the, quote, important principle, end quote, of diplomatic immunity. Obama told reporters yesterday during the White House news conference, he said, obviously, we're concerned about the loss of life. You know, we're not callous about that, but there's a broader principle at stake that I think we have to uphold. That's what the President of the United States said. All these people dead, and the Pakistan authorities want to investigate or try. I don't know what they're going to do. I have no idea. Maybe they would just pronounce him guilty and behead him. I don't know. But the U.S. government, i.e. Barack Obama and now John Kerry, are insisting that the Pakistan government recognize diplomatic immunity and let this guy go. Let him go. Kerry told reporters when he got to Lahore, quote, I want to come here today to express our deepest regret for this tragic event, to express the sorrow of the American people for the loss of life that has taken place, end quote. The sorrow of the American people? Really? Did you know anything about this, American people? Hey, American people! Yo, did you know about this? Are you full of regret? Do we express regret, Senator Kerry, every time a group of children playing in a school playground in some godforsaken village in the mountains of Pakistan are blown away, blown into meat chunks, when we decide to unload one of our Hellfire missiles? Nobody ever says anything then. Come on, John, Senator Kerry. God damn it, you were a Democratic nominee for president, right? I come here today to express our deepest regret for this tragic event and to express the sorrow of the American people for the loss of life that has taken place. What kind of an apology is that? Is he apologizing for the two alleged robbers? At least that's what the former Special Forces CIA, now diplomat, says. Well, they tried to rob me. Okay. So I had to kill him. Okay. And the guy on the motorbike, well, you know, collateral damage. And the wife who drank rat poison, well, collateral damage. You know, these people are crazy. Jesus Christ, they set themselves on fire. They drink rat poison. They behead each other. What the hell do you expect? So what do we have? Pakistan? Afghanistan? Oh, I left out Afghanistan. Let me put that in. The Times of London is reporting that General David Petraeus is to leave his post as commander of U.S. and NATO forces in Afghanistan by the end of the year. The Times says that the Pentagon, you know, this building plans to replace General Petraeus. The Pentagon. It'll be the first time in the history of U.S. military transitions that a building decides to replace General Petraeus. But that's what it says here. It says, the Times can reveal that the Pentagon aims to replace General Petraeus, who was appointed less than 8 months ago, by the end of the year. What do you suppose a departure by Petraeus will mean about our involvement in Afghanistan? What do you think? What do you think, huh? Petraeus' departure has been hinted at, apparently, and it's possible he may be looking at a promotion. He wants a promotion. He wants to take over the job that Admiral Mike Mullen has, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Mullen's expected to retire in October. Robert Gates is retiring this year, too. So there goes Petraeus, there goes Gates, there goes Mike Mullen. Oh, now, there is a response from the Department of Defense. All right. They, Department of Defense spokesman, Morrell. What's his name? Morrell? What's his first name? God damn it, here, what's his first name? Don't have his first name. Defense spokesman Morrell, quote, despite some sensational speculation by one of the London papers, I can assure you General Petraeus is not quitting. But nor does he plan to stay in Afghanistan forever. God, don't you love that? Obviously, he will rotate out at some point. But not yet determined or anytime soon. Well, soon is a relative concept, right? This is what, February and December? That's not soon. That's a million news cycles away. So there you have it. Times of London reporting General David Petraeus is going. And, of course, you already knew, didn't you, that Secretary of War is leaving. Robert Gates, he's leaving. So there we have it. How's that, folks, for a sweeping report from Pakistan, where an American is being charged with murder, to Afghanistan, where a military man who some feel has committed lots of murder, to Bahrain, well, we're jumping ahead here geographically, where that's where the U.S. Navy's Fifth Fleet is home-based, Bahrain. They're demanding that their leader get the hell out. To Iran, to Iraq, to Yemen, to Libya, and, of course, Egypt and Tunisia. Holy Toledo. Is that, how about that, huh? Oh, let's not leave out Wisconsin. Wisconsin is suffering through some horrific unrest even as we speak. And pretty soon, Mississippi, not too much longer, Florida. How's your canned goods supply? You got a lot of got a lot of canned goods. We'll be right back. Before the hour, and one more thing from the Middle East. Isn't that a thrilling part of the world? Aren't you glad, True Seeker, that we have been so heavily involved there for the past 50 years? Huh? Hasn't it been rewarding? It really has kept the flow of oil coming into our country so that we could do all the wonderful things that we have done. Are you being cynical, Malloy? Yes. Yes, I really, really am. One last thing, though, in today's or tonight's compendium of news from the Middle East, the Iraqi defector known as Curveball. Remember him? Remember Curveball? He's the one that provided all that information for U.S. claims that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. Huh? Rafid Ahmad Alwan Al-Janabi. Easier to say curveball. He has admitted that he lied. He told the Guardian newspaper that he made up all those stories about Saddam's arsenal because, quote, I had the chance to fabricate something to topple the regime. I and my sons are proud of that. And we are proud that we were the reason to give Iraq the margin of democracy, end quote. All those claims were the kind of the basis for then Secretary of State Colin Powell's speech to the U.N. Security Council 5 years. It was before we invaded. That's right, in 2000. Remember that? Powell mentioned an Iraqi engineer who described, quote, biological weapons factories on wheels, end quote. Remember that? They had pictures of it. Remember? They had drawings of it. Al-Janabi now tells the Guardian newspaper he never was involved in any program. He said he used his chemical engineering knowledge to make up stuff. He said he told the stories to the German intelligence agency, BNB, which passed them on to the CIA. And Curveball, who now says that removing Saddam from office justified the invasion of Iraq, even after more than 500,000 civilian deaths, nearly 5,000 American deaths, a complete destruction of an entire country and civilization. Mr. Curveball now says, quote, believe me, there was no other way to bring about freedom to Iraq. There were no other possibilities, end quote. All righty. So there you go. Moms and dads of America and our coalition partners in Iraq. It was all a series of goddamn horrific lies. Of course, the American political left has been trying to tell the rest of this country that truth for the past 9 years. Nobody would listen. So let me ask you something, truth seekers, as we are bringing tonight's thrilling program to a close. The lies of one man fed through the intelligence apparatus of the United States and some of our key allies has resulted in, pick a number, pick one out of the air, 500,000, 1,000,000, 2,000,000, how many dead? Who cares? Nobody knows. One death is a crime. 1,000,000 deaths is a statistic. So who knows? Who cares? But let me ask you something, truth seekers. You think it was worth it? Look at how democracy, truth, justice, and whatever is flourishing in Iraq this evening. Huh? Isn't it glorious? So, after all the death and the bloodshed, all engineered by not just Curveball. Curveball was just the guy who was probably paid. He's had a sanctuary. He's had political asylum someplace for the past decade. But the mad ravings of one man filtered through the U.S. intelligence services, twisted into this horrific assault on innocent people by Dick Cheney and George W. Bush. Let me ask you something. What do you think will happen when Dick Cheney and George W. Bush stand before God Almighty on that great getting up morning, that judgment day that surely is coming? Amen. What do you think God will say? Thank you, Dick, for murdering all those filthy Muslims. I really do appreciate it. And George, thank you for being the brain-dead little twit that operated as, snicker, snicker, President of the United States while I unleashed the fury of my disciple, Dick Cheney. Do you think that's what will be said, or do you think God will look at the two of them and say, hold still while I pinch off your heads and cast you into hell? Astonishing. Just astonishing. And you all wonder sometimes why I get so bizarre on this little 25-cent radio program. Huh? All right, well, that's all. Listen, thanks for hanging out tonight. I certainly do appreciate it. Let's see what happens. I wonder when we... You know what's going to happen? I'm pretty convinced of it now. Pakistan is going to attack India. Ooh. I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care. Oh, and don't forget, Hosni Mubarak. He's on death's door. You heard it here first. I'll see you tomorrow night. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.